December 2017. Nadia Atwee's vehicle is discovered wedged into some bushes at a park near her home.
Just want to tell her that I love her. Come back today. I would forget about what happened.
But Nadia is never seen again.
If I go back, I would react differently, but I didn't know.
The next call, the case of Nadia Atwee, available now on the CBC Listen app and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast. Rome's Trevi Fountain, the Taj Mahal, Buckingham Palace. It used to be hard to imagine the world's most famous sites without throngs of tourists in front of them. Then the pandemic gave us a taste of a world without tourism. It caused economic hardship for many big tourist spots, but it also made a huge dent in global carbon emissions. And all that got Vancouver writer and broadcaster Steve Burgess thinking about his own misgivings about travel, despite years as an avid globetrotter himself. His new book is called Reservations, The Pleasures and Perils of Travel. And Steve joins me from Vancouver. Good morning, Steve.
Thrilled to be here.
Well, you begin with the question, and it could it be that every vacation is essentially a guilt trip? What do you mean by that?
Well, I just mean that it's more complicated than it used to be, isn't it? I mean, it's not. It's simply not the simple pleasure-seeking activity that it once was. And, you know, it hasn't always been pleasure-seeking for people either. There's always been the element of travel that it is supposed to be a broadening experience, supposed to make you a better person, or it might just be it's supposed to make you a more tanned person, you know, with a Mai Tai on the beach. Either motive was fine. But now it's just become more complicated. If you are someone who is not blind to the issues that we face today, there's no doubt about it that you're going to look in the mirror and say, wait a minute, can I justify what I'm doing?
Okay. What are those issues, though, that you mentioned?
There are a number of them. The most prominent, obviously, is emissions.
Right.
And the kind of flights that are far and away the greatest emitters are the kind of flights that Canadians almost have to take to get anywhere. The short-haul flights are a relatively small contributor to the emissions. It's the long-haul flights, the kind that I take if I want to go to Rome, right, which I love to do. So there's no doubt about it. If you have any kind of awareness of our climate problem, a trip becomes a guilt trip, you know.
But you've got a great line in the book where you say that tourism does not just consume, it feeds.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, I mean, yes, there are the downsides, but there are many upsides. And how do you see
absolutely
those?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and that is the thing. You don't want to, I don't think you want to fall into the trap of just saying tourism bad. I would be a massive hypocrite if I said that because I have traveled. Obviously, I'm talking a great deal about my own travels and I don't plan to stop traveling. And when you talk about tourism, you know, the United Nations studies that were done during the pandemic indicated that not all of the effects on the environment were positive when tourism stopped. Yes, emissions went down, but when you have tourism suddenly coming to an abrupt halt, you have situations where sightseeing and whale watching or whatever gives way to shark hunting, whale hunting. If you don't have alternative ways for people to make money off the land, then they go back to the traditional ways of making money off the land, and those are not environmentally beneficial. So it's not all on one side.
Well, you mentioned it in your book, and there's some great examples of you traveling the world, and we inherently, so many people love to travel. I mean, Canadians are known for that we love to travel. What do you love about traveling?
You know, you get the bug. You get the bug or you don't. I think most people do have the bug. But there was a chapter in the book that I eventually cut out because I just thought the book was running long. But it detailed my early history of travel as a hitchhiker way back in the glory days of hitchhiking, because I am that old. And, the highways were full of kids like me. And I think in those days, it was just the romance of the counterculture. I thought, you know, this is where the exciting life is lived, you know, out on the road. I had that idea that that travel was exciting and romantic from an early age. And I think, you know, I grew up in Brandon, Manitoba. And the funny thing is now I travel back to Brandon, Manitoba whenever I can. But when you're young and when you're in Brandon, Manitoba, you're not thinking, wow, this is the center of the universe. You are in a hurry to get somewhere else. Real life is happening somewhere other than where you are. Certainly when you're young.
You mentioned in the book this idea of the quest for utopia. And you certainly, anybody who's anywhere near the internet will see that utopia is everywhere except usually where you are.
That's right.
And that seems to be also feeding this wanderlust that so many people have, that it's always better somewhere else. I just have to get there.
Right. And that's where you start getting into complicated stuff, too, about the way that social media influencers are painting travel. Because it's easy to demonize those people. And I went into that chapter thinking, you know, social media influencers bad. But I was talking to a woman named Dr. Ulrike Gretzel, who was, you know, telling me that she was explaining to me that I'm being too hard on social media influencers. And the fact many of them serve an important role. And also they're serving the same role that used to be served by newspaper travel sections or just friends recommending things. But One of the byproducts of social media influencing is the fact that there is a sort of a shallow picture that is painted of a particular place. And even Dr. Gretzel was pointing out that there's this isolated suspension bridge in Austria that a lot of influencers are taking pictures of. And you see this beautiful picture of the bridge. Well, now the bridge is overrun. And not only that, but the pictures don't show you how hard the bridge is to get to. So there's all of these people who think, oh, I'm going to go to this beautiful spot I saw on Instagram. And they don't realize that it's an arduous hike. And then in the meantime, all of the people making that arduous hike are quite possibly desecrating the landscape in doing so. So there is a picture of utopia that gets painted online, and it is unavoidably a shallow version of travel. And I also think that kind of thing tends to encourage a kind of travel that I'm not particularly fond of, the get there, see it, and go.
Right.
Bucket list kind of travel, which I really think is the shallowest form, you know?
But to get to utopia, Steve, you have to start at the airport. And what is it about airports that seem to trigger our stress responses? You liken them to a taste of staying in a medium security prison.
There's these incredibly long lineups, and you think, there ought to be Space Mountain at the end of this lineup. Any lineup that I'm going to stand in this long should have a ride at the end of it. And it does, but it's, you know, and a ride in a cramped tube. No, it's like The modern security state is for our own good, but it's just there's no way around it. It's going to drive you crazy. I took a couple of trips to complete research for the book last year, and at one point I had a stranger just telling me, "Calm down, buddy, just calm down."
I
was that guy. I was just starting to be like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this?
Well, what? Tell us about what happened with the French customs official at the Charles de Gaulle Airport.
Oh, man. Okay, this story requires some bleeping. It's a popular story. It was early in the morning. It was really early in the morning. I'd already had a bad day. I think I lost my passport or something. So by the time I got through customs, I was already very frazzled. But I was going to customs to try to get the VAT tax refund. This is where if you do some shopping, they give you a value-added tax refund, but they make it as difficult as possible. Technically, you're supposed to be able to show them the goods that you bought. But most of the time, they just let you show the receipts, right? Because what if you've done a lot of shopping? You can't take all that stuff through security, right? There's too much of it. At least in my case, I'd done a lot of shopping. And so I just had the receipts. So I was at Charles de Gaulle, and I walk up to the booth, and there's this fellow, and he's got the peaked cap, and he's got the blue shirt. He's got the little mustache. And I say, "Here's my receipts." And he says, "The merchandise, monsieur." And I said, look at all those receipts. Look at them. You can see how many receipts there are. You know I couldn't possibly bring all that merchandise through security. I had to pack it. And he said, "The merchandise, monsieur." And I had all these forms in my hand, and I was frazzled. And I threw the forms into the air in a blizzard of paper, And I began screaming at the guy, bleep you, bleep you, bleep you. And he sat there, and his cap was unmoved, and his shirt was unruffled, and his face was unruffled. And he said to me, bleep you, monsieur. And I was told that was it.
But this touches on another point of your the book, where tourists, you know, the notion of tourist is used almost as a slur in some instances, that there's something so negative connotations about tourists. When I traveled, I called them bad ambassadors, and they're people who are just bad ambassadors for their country. And does that also have that sort of negative impact on travel itself?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like you have destinations that are starting to rebel.
Yeah.
You know, you have Amsterdam. Like, it just blows me away that Amsterdam put out an ad campaign and their slogan was, stay away. Like, what kind of world do we live in when a destination is putting out the message to tourists, stay away? And it's because, like, they had this ad campaign that would pop up on YouTube anytime someone punched in the words, stag party Amsterdam. Because there's a certain type of tourist who is basically a hard partying tourist that no jurisdiction wants them. There's a chapter in the book, you know, Dr. Hazel Andrews, who did from Liverpool. She did a study on British tourists in Magaluf, which young people in Britain refer to as Shagaloof. And it's just an ongoing, rolling, roistering party. And, you know, people die. People fall off balconies. They dive from balconies into pools and kill themselves. And there are fights that are sometimes fatal. There was a guy who ended up in hospital after attempting to defecate off a balcony railing. Who really wants those kind of tourists?
Right.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You explore in your own travels, and you mentioned how much you love to travel, is how you want to make contact with the locals and do some good. You met a girl named Quina in Nepal, and tell us about that, because you were sort of pulled into her life where you wanted to be the good ambassador. You wanted to be the good tourist.
This is the kind of naivete that I think, unfortunately, a lot of us fall into, and we think that we're going to be the, you know, fairy god people sprinkling gold dust. I'll just detour a little bit by saying that one of the things that surprised me about this book was finding out the near universal contempt there is in the industry for volunteerism. This is where people travel in order to do good works. And according to the people I've talked to, it seems like it's been entirely captured by cynical opportunists who sell naive people these tours that are supposed to help people, and really all they really help is the tour guide. You know, let's go paint the orphanage again. Well, the orphanage has been painted 8 times, and not only that, it's not really an orphanage because it's just been set up for tourism, and the kids aren't even orphans. They're just poor kids that have been basically taken from their homes. The parents were told that they'd get a good education or something. There's no adoptions going on. It's
a prop.
It's a prop and it's a scam. So a lot of volunteerism falls into that trap. What happened to me was I was in Kathmandu and I was walking through Darbar Square, and there was a family there with a blanket selling stuff. And there was Quina was a young woman. She was 15 years old, and she just had this bright, infectious smile, and she was selling me a little Nepalese game called Tigers and Goats, which is a fascinating little game, actually. It's a story in itself. But she was telling me about her dream to be a doctor and to do good, and then she invited me to come back and visit, and I did. I came back, and then I went to her family's home, and, you know, they made me tea and everything, and I kind of felt like maybe there was another shoe that was going to drop here. But, you know, what do you get? They were very nice. And Quina was obviously a vivacious and lovely young person who had big dreams, and you want to support those. So sure enough, once I got back to Canada, requests for money started to come. And, you know, at first I decided that that was okay, especially since I wrote a magazine article about her. And so I thought, well, I'm getting paid for the magazine article. Why shouldn't she get paid? I sent money, I think, two or three times by Western Union. And then I thought, wait a minute, I'm starting to feel like a pump here, you know, that's being primed. So I stopped. But then the big earthquake hit. And I know that it devastated the very area where they were. So I got a pleading email from her, and it certainly had the ring of authenticity. And I began sending money again. The sad little coda is that eventually I got a photograph, a letter that purported to be from Quina's father, saying that Quina had been in a serious car accident. Quina needs money, and or else, you know, we can't do the surgery. And I thought, oh no, you know, I just like, could it be possible? Could it be true? And I thought, I really don't think so. And sure enough, about a year later, I got an email from Quina saying, I saw that magazine article you wrote. I wish you would take it offline. I don't like it. So I thought, oh, good. Well, she survived. She survived without my money. But the thing is, someone was telling me when I was, you know, discussing this case, said, what do you expect her to do? Like, what did you think you were doing there? Did you think you were going to have an ordinary relationship with someone where there is that tremendous economic disparity? And obviously, I represent an opportunity.
But when it comes down to it, because you touch on something there that a lot of tourists are seen as being, you know, wealthy and privileged. But has that changed over the year with global travel now? How have you seen that change?
Well, but the thing is, it's how you judge it. Like, I look at myself in Canada and I think, well, I'm just scraping by. I'm buying wilted lettuce, you know, to save a dollar or two. But on a global scale, I am at the very tippy top of the pyramid. And this is like a great guy that I was talking to with Giulio Mattioli at the University of Dortmund. And he's saying, look, not like the world's population are not on airplanes. It's the global north that are on airplanes, not the global south. Right. And so those of us who are even cramped in economy and feeling hard done by and feeling like peasants, air peasants, we are in the global elite. And so that's when Giulio Mattioli was making the point that we are kind of soaking up everybody else's emissions budget. You know, when we fly, we say, look, we're just, you know, we're just taking a flight every once in a year and everything. Yeah, but most of the world isn't flying. So we're the ones who are doing the emitting on behalf of everybody else.
Okay, and let's talk about that, because I know on this program I've interviewed people before about this idea of sustainable aviation fuel and some of the programs that have been coming up, that fuel derived from agricultural or synthetic materials.
Or even taken from carbon sucked out of the air.
Yeah. So these are ideas, but just how realistic is it that we're going to have this sort of green air travel in the near future?
Near future? No. And that's the thing. That was one of the most depressing things about writing the book, because I want to keep traveling and I don't want to feel guilty. And so I thought, oh, come on, technology, ride over the hill to my rescue. Well, the story that I got from a number of people I talked to is that technology is definitely coming, but it's not coming as quickly as we need it to come. We need to do things now to cut emissions, and the technological solutions are not going to be here for a little while yet. Like, there's a company that does make jet fuel out of carbon that's sucked out of the air. And there have been test flights of this sustainable air fuel, which is, you know, it only emits as much carbon as it took out of the air. So it's absolutely zero emissions, totally. But the thing is, the only thing that this company has made so far is vodka and perfume. So they have not reached the level where they can really scale up to the aviation level. And one fellow I was talking to, and this kind of surprised me because he was basically a booster for the airline industry. But when I was talking to him about technology, he said, look, even when this stuff starts to come online, how long is it going to take for these new aircraft to work their way into the fleet? Because it's not like the airlines are going to retire all of their existing planes as soon as the sustainable airline fuels planes come on board. It's going to be a long, slow process. So you're talking about decades. And the consensus is we need to do something now. So, you know, the solutions, I do think the solutions will come.
Well, one of the solutions are certainly that's being, you know, tested now, and we're seeing it, it just began in Venice, is to charge a 5 euro entry fee.
Oh,
it's a tourist tax that'll apply on weekends. It's trying to discourage visitors when the city is likely to be at capacity. So that started, and apparently on day one was called a recipe for disaster for the chaos and confusions it's causing people. In Quebec, they want to bring this in between May and October to visit the Magdalen Islands, a $30 archipelago pass. What do you think about that? Charging people to try to monitor and lessen the capacity?
I'm in favor of it in general, because when you think about it, like what the Magdalen Islands are doing, it's not that different from what the national parks do. You have to pay to get into a national park.
Yep, fair.
But the thing is, it's going to be difficult when you're telling people, say, in Quebec, you've got to pay to go from one part of Quebec to another. I don't know. There's going to be pushback. But, you know, the thing is, I'm in favor of the concept for sure. But the Venice is the poster city for so many problems in tourism. And you're seeing this latest thing, you know, a ticket costs a little bit more than 5 euros. But the bureaucracy of trying to sort out who's supposed to have a ticket and who isn't, because if you have a hotel stay, you don't have to buy the ticket. It's only for day trippers. So how do you prove you're a hotel guest? This is turning out to be a massive bureaucratic screw up. And they've tried other things, like they tried turnstiles for a while, and the locals rebelled against that. And they've tried, you know, banning the cruise ships from the lagoon. Venice is a city where tourism is its lifeblood and also its poison. And Venice is being consumed by tourism. It's like there's no there anymore, because the permanent resident base is shrinking and shrinking. So Venice is really like the canary in the global coal mine. If your goal is to try to cut back the crowds in Venice, 5 euros is not going to do it. You got to get serious about it.
So where do you land, though, at the end of the day, Steve, for the research that you've done, the travel that you've done? Let's give us a spoiler alert here. Is travel a virtue or a sin?
I think that's the central issue that my book wrestles with. And I really did naively kind of hope when I started writing the book that I would have an easy answer. And I don't. But here's the thing I will say. I do think that travel is virtuous. Yes, it has issues pertaining to it, but it is virtuous. You just think about if you could wave a magic wand and wipe out travel, do you think that would be good for humanity? I do not think so. You know, there's got to be benefit from international travel. And also, just on a personal level, I really do think that travel can help make you a better person if it's done right. So absolutely, I'm pro travel. And the other thing is that, and I hope this isn't too cynical, but you're not going to put a stop to it. You know, there are people I have in my book who are talking about some extreme measures about halting air travel. But think about trying to get the political consensus to make air travel prohibitively expensive, when you see just the fact that the politics surrounding the carbon tax. Imagine trying to finagle the politics around trying to make air travel prohibitively expensive in order to cut back on travel. It would be political suicide. So it's not going to happen. I hope that's not just throwing up the hands and giving up and going, oh, well, we might as well all do all the traveling we want because nobody's going to stop it, because there are harmful effects. But I do think in the end, travel is absolutely worthwhile, essential even. It's just that it's just more complicated and fraught with difficulty than it used to be.
Steve, I wish you happy trails.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
Steve Burgess is a writer and broadcaster in Vancouver. His new book is called Reservations: The Pleasures and Perils of Travel. So how has your thinking about travel evolved? Is it more of a virtue or a sin? What do you think? Are you making different decisions about where to go and how to get there? We at The Current would love to hear from you as you ponder that question. So fire us off an email at thecurrent@cbc.ca.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.